two speakers in alphabetical order. First, Marshall Dayan, who received his J.D. in 1986 from Antioch School of Law, and he has been involved in the anti-death penalty movement since 1981. He currently works for the Capital Habeas Unit of the Federal Defender's Office in Pittsburgh, where he serves as an assistant federal public defender. He's also an adjunct professor at Pitt's Law School, where he teaches a capital punishment class. And he has served on the as a chair of the board of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, president of the People of Faith Against the Death Penalty in North Carolina, and vice chair on the Commission on Social Action for Reform Judaism. He has also served as co-chair of the board of Pennsylvania's for Alternatives to Death Penalty, and he is vice president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Pennsylvania ACLU. And he is also active in the Jewish community, having served as president of the board of the Pittsburgh Area Jewish Committee. Elizabeth DeLosa, Liz, is our second speaker. I'm going to introduce them both here at the same time. And Liz received her JD from Duquesne University in 2010. After law school, she was recruited by the Allegheny County Office of Conflict Counsel to develop the Juvenile Delinquency and Juvenile Dependency Division of that office. Subsequently, she joined the Office of Conflict Counsel's Adult Trial Unit, where she represented adult criminal clients in cases ranging in severity from summary disorderly conduct to first-degree homicide. In 2014, she and her husband moved to the U.S. Virgin Islands, where she gained federal criminal trial experience through her work as a research and writing attorney and assistant federal defender in the District of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Liz currently serves as the managing attorney for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project's Pittsburgh office, which is located in Duquesne University School of Law. And the Pennsylvania Innocence Project works to exonerate those convicted of crimes they did not commit and to prevent innocent people from being convicted. So I'll turn the program over to our two speakers.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening. I'm going to tell a few stories, and then Liz is going to follow me, and then I'll tell another couple stories, and then we'll just answer some questions, okay? So, some of you have heard these stories, and, you know, hang in there. I'll try and embellish them so that they sound different. I was a junior at the University of Georgia in the spring of 1980 when the state of Georgia announced that it was going to carry out its first execution in 20 years. And I heard this on the campus radio station, and I thought to myself, in a democratic society, if my government is going to kill somebody, that means that I am. I ought to think about this, because, you know, that's pretty serious business. So I decided to drive the 50 miles from Athens, Georgia, to Atlanta, Georgia, for a vigil the night before the scheduled execution. And I found myself at the Central Presbyterian Church in downtown Atlanta, right across the street from Georgia's Golden Domed Capitol building. And I listened to lawyers and clergy people talk about the death penalty. And I found myself in the back pew of that church, nauseous and weeping at the idea that the state of Georgia was going to put blood on my hands against my will. And I thought about my own faith tradition, in which I was taught that instead of completing the creation of the universe in 6 days, the Almighty created us to be partners in completing the creation, to be partners in bringing about the kind of world that we all want to live in one day. And I wondered how we could throw away any creatures of the Almighty that, according to my Bible, my Torah, are created the Tzelem Elohim, in the image of God. And that while people do bad things, people are neither good nor evil, they're both. And do both. And I couldn't make the nausea go away until a little light bulb went off over my head. And I decided, I know what I can do to try and keep the blood off my hands. I can go to law school and learn how to represent people who are charged with or convicted of capital crimes. And I've been doing that ever since that spring evening in 1980. And I had hoped that by this time, 40 years later, that I would be in some other line of work. But sadly, I'm not in another line of work. I'm still doing this. As you can tell from my story, going into this line of work was a completely selfish enterprise. It was all to make me feel better. And it has kept the nausea away for 40 years. During the course of that period of time, what I've learned is that we in the United States say we like the death penalty, although there is a very, very recent Gallup poll that for the first time in more than 50 years, more people say they prefer life without parole to capital punishment as the appropriate response to the worst homicides in our society. But though we say that we like it, we don't really. Here in Pennsylvania, for example, we have the fifth largest death row in America, and almost nobody knows that. But we are behind only California, Florida, Texas, and Alabama in terms of the largest death rows in the country. And yet, we haven't executed anyone in Pennsylvania in this millennium. We haven't executed anyone since 1999. Among the things that I've learned in the work that I've done is that we say we like the death penalty for particularly horrific homicides, but what we really like is imposing it on people who kill white people. We like imposing it on people who are not from our community. We like imposing it on poor people who can't afford quality representation, and as a result, sometimes get good representation from public defenders or court-appointed lawyers, and sometimes don't get very good representation from court-appointed lawyers or public defenders. You know, early in my career, what I couldn't understand was, as we were presenting to the courts these claims about race discrimination and classism and prosecutorial misconduct that is rampant in capital cases and ineffective assistance of defense counsel that is rampant in capital cases, courts didn't care very much. And people, frankly, set the courts aside. The courts at least care once in a while. But when I would, you know, talk to people in, you know, community groups like you guys tonight, most people didn't care. And I couldn't quite understand, how can you not care about racism and classism, the system not working right either because of prosecutorial misconduct or because of ineffective assistance of counsel? And all that changed in 1998. It began to change anyway. In 1998, Northwestern University Law School held a national conference on wrongful convictions and the death penalty. And of the 78 people who had been proven to be innocent of the homicides for which they were convicted beyond a reasonable doubt and sentenced to death, of the 78 people who had been convicted and sentenced to death at that time, that's in 1998, 23 of them were in that room, that auditorium in Chicago, in November of 1998. And each of those 23 people walked across the stage and said, My name is Randall Dale Adams. If the state of Texas had had its way, I wouldn't be here. I would be dead. And you can't imagine the power of hearing 23 people say those words, replacing only their names and the states which convicted them and sentenced them to die. And once that message started to get out, that our system of criminal justice, whether we're talking about capital cases or not, but particularly in capital cases where the issue is life or death, where the system is so broken, so flawed, so rampant with racism and classism, prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective assistance of counsel. And people heard about innocent people who were sentenced to death. They began to ask themselves, how could this happen? How is it that our system that we believe in, you know, that we all watch when we watch Law and Order and Special Victims Unit and Criminal Intent and Chicago PD, etc., 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 how is it that this system, which we so believe in, which has these constitutional protections, which require the state to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt, how is it that innocent people can be convicted and sentenced to death? The answers to that question are racism and classism and prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective assistance of counsel. And all of a sudden, very slowly, people across the country began to say, oh, now I get it. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about Pennsylvania, I've practiced in lots of states, I've practiced in Virginia and in North Carolina, and had a case in Delaware, have a case in Missouri, have a case in Ohio. Not every state requires prospective jurors to answer the following question: will you give more weight to the testimony of a police officer or a law enforcement officer than to other witnesses? And here you have to say no. Now, people learn that they have to say no, but you have to say no in Pennsylvania. I won't give more weight to a law enforcement officer's testimony simply because the witness is a law enforcement officer. Nevertheless, we do. We tend to trust law enforcement officers, and when they testify, we believe them. But since the innocence movement began in the country and this Northwestern Law School conference on wrongful convictions and the death penalty began to shine a light on how broken our system is, people less and less trust our system. And with good reason, because our system has lots and lots of flaws. A little later, after Liz has spoken to you, and maybe and perhaps during questions, I'm going to tell you about this report. This is the Joint State Government Commission report on capital punishment in Pennsylvania. It was released in June of 2018. And I was one of the 30 members of the advisory committee that worked on preparing this report. And we were asked to study 17 issues related to capital punishment, from cost to quality of counsel to race discrimination, and other kinds of bias and unfairness, mental illness, intellectual disability, the appellate and post-conviction process, 17 issues related to how capital punishment works in Pennsylvania. And in this report, we conclude that our system is severely broken. And we make all kinds of recommendations about how the system could be fixed, how the system could be. Now, frankly, I don't believe, just to be quick, I don't believe that we can fix capital punishment sufficiently. I just don't think we can. I don't think it can work. But those people who do believe in capital punishment certainly ought to be working to try and fix what everyone conceives as a broken system. All of the things that we recommended in this report, or at least many of them, have been recommended before. There was an ABA study, done, an American Bar Association study done of Pennsylvania's capital punishment system in 2008. It had recommendations. There was a study on bias in the death penalty in 2003. It had recommendations. We've got studies that stack up this high. How many of those recommendations do you think have been implemented? None. We don't take them seriously. But there are ways that we can fix our system and make our system better. We have to have the will to do it. And when I say we, I mean all of us. Right? That's in a democratic society. We are all responsible. So with that, I'm going to ask Liz to continue.
Okay. Hey, everyone. My name is Liz DeLosa. I'm the managing attorney for the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. And I require a volunteer. So, Pat, can I bug you?
Sure.
Will you just turn my slides for me?
Yeah.
Thank you. Everyone, this is Patrick Fapur. He is a University of Pittsburgh law student. He was also an intern with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and an excellent one at that. And so, unfortunately, he has been selected to be called out. okay, so Pat, if you could just turn the slide here. So I'm going to... Marshall has told you about the ways in which our system is flawed and leads to wrongful convictions, leads to the innocent being convicted, the innocent being put on death row. And I'm gonna tell you a little bit about the Pennsylvania men and women who have been exonerated since 2009. Through the work of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and I'm going to give you just those primary causes kind of in real time and how those play out in real life so that you can understand how prosecutorial misconduct works, what we see on a day-to-day basis, how racial bias works, and just all of those reasons and what we see on a day-to-day basis, and what are the things that we can do as a society, as real people, to combat all of those reasons. Lance Felder was one of our very first clients. He wrote to us in 2009 when we opened our office in Philadelphia. Lance Felder and Eugene Gilliard were co-defendants. You'll see Eugene's picture in just a moment. They spent 15 years in jail for a homicide that they did not commit. The primary cause of their wrongful conviction, and you will see this repeated over and over and over and over, is eyewitness misidentifications. Eyewitness misidentifications is the primary reason for wrongful convictions in non-capital wrongful convictions. It is 3 out of 4 of every wrongful convictions there is an eyewitness misidentification. So an eyewitness gets on the stand and says, I am absolutely sure that this is the person who committed this crime. And are they lying? No. They're not lying. They're mistaken. And why are they mistaken? Because they have been through a traumatic incident, and because there are ways in which police procedures could help to ensure that their identifications are more accurate that we simply do not adhere to. So, for example, We show witnesses. We do show-up procedures, which means that we bring suspects directly to the witness and say, "Is this the suspect?" While a suspect is in a police car with handcuffs, it's suggested. We show witnesses photographs that are out of a book of mugshots. We show witnesses photo arrays, which means that we show witnesses an array of photos that is like four photos on top, four photos on bottom, which causes witnesses to compare the photos to one another while comparing them to their memory. There are better practices in which to do these identifications, and we simply just do not adhere to these best practices, despite knowing what the best practices are. Mr. Lance Felder was accused of a robbery homicide. The robbery homicide was, the identification was made by the daughter of the robbery victim. Okay? It was made from 135 feet away from a second-story apartment building window. And the window was obscured by an air conditioning unit that was in that window. That daughter was shown, first of all, she was traumatized. She watched her father being shot to death, robbed and shot to death. And what do we know? Well, we know that traumatizing occurrences they change memories. When you are subjected to a traumatizing event, you don't remember more, you remember less. And so I've had many juries say to me, "Oh, if I was subjected to that, I would never forget that face." Well, unfortunately, that's just not how memory works. Stress decreases your memory for salient details. It doesn't increase your memory for details. So this woman watched her father be shot. She was far away, so she wasn't able to see the details of the perpetrator's face. She also had an obstructed view, and then she was shown several pictures over the course of several months leading into several years. And she was shown several times Lance and his co-defendant Eugene's pictures. So while she was shown several pictures, she was only shown a repeat picture of Lance and Eugene. So eventually, while she started to feel that familiar feeling for Lance and Eugene, it was because she started to see their picture over and over again by police. Eventually, when she got to trial, she was sure that it was Lance and Eugene. The only evidence against Lance and Eugene was the daughter's identification. They both spent 15 years incarcerated for this homicide. They were incarcerated, luckily, with a man who went by the street name Rolex. Rolex was incarcerated for three consecutive life sentences. He had given up hope of having any kind of appeals or getting out of prison, had begun to attend services, had a crisis of conscience, and admitted that he was the actual perpetrator of this robbery. Could corroborate some facts of this robbery that had never been corroborated before, and made a statement. So Mr. Rolex came forward and testified on behalf of Lance and Eugene, and then we were able to do some forensic testing that corroborated Rolex's testimony. And so Lance and Eugene were exonerated after serving 15 years. Eyewitness misidentification was the primary cause of their wrongful conviction, although bad lawyering was a secondary cause of their wrongful conviction. Okay, next, Pat. Jim Fogel. Mr. Fogel is an exoneration out of Indiana County over here on the western side of the state. His primary cause is incentivized testimony. Mr. Fogel is the longest serving exoneree here in Pennsylvania. He was exonerated through DNA, evidence. Mr. Fogel was convicted of the rape and homicide of a 15-year-old girl. A man confessed to the rape and homicide of this 15-year-old girl after a party. The man was a relation of a Indiana County police officer. The Indiana County police officer did not believe that this person could have committed this rape and homicide. He was not arrested. The man then implicated Mr. Fogel and his brother. Mr. Fogel and his brother were then arrested and prosecuted. They then served several years in prison. The original suspect was psychiatrically admitted. And he implicated a third person who was then prosecuted. That person served several years in prison. No DNA testing was done for several years because DNA testing didn't exist at the time. And when Mr. Fogel tried to obtain DNA testing, when it became a technology that was available, the Indiana County Police Department told him that the DNA or that the biological evidence wasn't available any longer, that it had been lost. So he spent a number of years just trying to find the evidence in order to have DNA testing done. He finally had the Pennsylvania Innocence Project and the Innocence Project from New York get involved. We finally found the evidence in order to have DNA testing done. He was exonerated. We were able to get an unknown male profile, so a clean profile that exonerated Mr. Fogel, and Indiana County refuses to have that profile compared to the state database or the national database. Meaning that there is a rapist and murderer that could be in the state database or national database that could be identified, but for fear that they would have to admit that they prosecuted the wrong man, they will not upload that profile. So they did vacate Mr. Fogel's conviction, but will not upload the profile into that database still to this day. The man that originally confessed to the crime testified against Mr. Fogel and was not charged. He is the incentivized testimony in Mr. Fogel's case. Next. So you could argue, and I would argue, that that is also prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct. Eugene Gilliard is Lance Felder's co-defendant, who I just told you about. So he is also eyewitness identification. Okay, next. Kenneth Granger is eyewitness identification and official misconduct. Mr. Granger spent 28 years incarcerated for a homicide that he did not commit. Mr. Granger... Mr. Granger's eyewitness was shown several photos, just like Lance and Eugene, of Mr. Granger. And later, while we were trying to obtain a new trial for Mr. Granger, we found evidence of additional alternative perpetrators that were never turned over to Mr. Granger's defense counsel during his trial, and other evidence of Mr. Granger's innocence that was never turned over by the police and by the prosecutor. So we have official misconduct in Mr. Granger's case. Mr. Hale. Mr. Hale is a particularly sad case. Mr. Hale served 33 years behind bars, 23 years of those he served in solitary confinement because he did not adjust well to incarceration. Mr. Hale's primary causes for wrongful conviction are eyewitness identification, faulty forensic science, and official misconduct. Mr. Hale is a sweet, sweet man, but a passionate man, and has always maintained his innocence. He was also convicted of a homicide for which he did not commit. Mr. Hale's case is a rape of a 15-year-old girl. The girl described her rapist as a 30-year-old black male standing 6 foot tall and weighing 180 pounds. Mr. Hale at the time was a 21-year-old light-skinned black male weighing 125 pounds. He did not match the description, as you can tell, of her rapist. The victim admitted that Mr. Hale's face resembled her rapist, but the rest of him did not match her description, and that at the time of her attack, he appeared much older. When they went to trial, the prosecution had to explain that the victim's blood type was O. At the time, there was no DNA testing, but the victim's blood type was type O. That they did blood typing on the semen present, and the blood type was B. And that they did blood typing on Marshall Hale, and his type was A. And the prosecution had to explain that type A blood could not have left type B secretions, and despite that, he was convicted. There were other pieces of exculpatory evidence, like witnesses that placed Mr. Hale at a local pub celebrating a friend's birthday, as well as witnesses who described an alternate perpetrator that were suppressed and not given to defense counsel. So there was exculpatory evidence that was suppressed by the prosecution and not given to defense counsel prior to trial in Mr. Hale's case. Mr. Hale's conviction was overturned after 33 years of incarceration after the Philadelphia County Conviction Integrity Unit looked at the forensic science and said, wait a minute, the perpetrator's blood type was obviously this. Mr. Hale's blood type was this. There is no way to, like, make sense of those two things, and they had their scientists go back through, and the scientist was like, this just doesn't make sense. He could not have been the perpetrator. And so Mr. Hale struggles to this day, as you can imagine, having spent 23 years in solitary confinement. Okay, next. Chester Holman. Primary causes are incentivized witness and official misconduct. Incentivized witness was a woman that he was on a date with. There was a drive-by shooting. There was a witness to the drive-by shooting who said that they saw the license plate, and the license plate had three letters, YZA. The police officers pulled over a car with the three letters of YZA. Mr. Holman was the driver, and he had a woman in the car. They brought both of the people into the homicide unit for questioning. Mr. Holman continued to maintain his innocence. Mr. Holman didn't match the description of the perpetrator. The car didn't match the description of the vehicle. He didn't have any weapons in the car. His clothing didn't match. He didn't have any gunshot residue. Nothing about the car or Mr. Holman matched except for the three letters of the license plate. After 12 hours, the woman made a false confession saying that she was a lookout for Mr. Holman and a friend. While he committed the crime, they're both convicted based on the woman's false confession. After we became involved in the case, we found that there were several other witness reports that identified an alternative perpetrator who eventually confessed to the crime and has since been prosecuted. Mr. Hugney was convicted of an arson. He was convicted of pouring gasoline around his son's bed and setting the bed on fire. He served 36 years for this arson. We had an expert look at the forensic science of this arson and found that what the experts originally said were traces of gasoline and patterns of accelerant. Actually could not be said to have been gasoline, and fire science in the last two decades has evolved. kind of complicated, but in the last several decades, fire investigation at one point used to be where we would read patterns of a fire and say, okay, fire started here, a fire burned more intensely here, it traveled here, that pour patterns, something must have been poured here. What we have discovered in the last several decades through the discovery of something called flashover. So flashover is a phenomenon that is a transition where a room transitions from fire inside a room to a room on fire, which means that not only is a room just have fire inside of it, but that a room becomes so hot that the smoke and the fumes inside the room become so hot that everything combusts and it blows out the windows, everything kind of blows out. And so when that occurs, when flashover occurs, you can no longer read those patterns. Those patterns are no longer readable in a way that we can say, oh, okay, well, the fire traveled here, because the fire is such a rolling and unpredictable monster. They were no longer able to say, oh, well, this V means that that's where the fire started, or this, if it's charred here, alligatored here, it must have burned more severely, or must have started here, or charred here, right? And so there is no way to kind of predict how the fire traveled, or how the fire started, or how the fire moved once flashover occurs. In Mr. Hugney's case, flashover occurred, especially in this son's room, where a kerosene heater was being used in order to heat that room. it was then deemed an accident. And so faulty forensic science is it was responsible for that fire. And Mr. Hugney unfortunately spent 36 years in prison for a fire that he was not only not responsible for, but that no crime was even committed. Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson has several primary causes: official misconduct, eyewitness misidentification, false testimony, and bad lawyering. Lorenzo's official misconduct, he had several pieces of exculpatory evidence that were withheld from his trial counsel. He had several witnesses that came forward while he was incarcerated awaiting trial that said that he admitted to committing this homicide in order to gain a favorable sentence on crimes that they were being charged with. They also gave false testimony in order to gain favorable sentencing. And then he had a really, really bad lawyer. Mr. Johnson had cell phone records. He had a great alibi. He was at Target, and he could prove through cell phone records that he picked up his girlfriend, called him and said, "Hey, I bought this comforter for our daughter. The comforter doesn't match the color purple that I want for her bedroom. Can you take me to Target so I can return it?" And so he drove over to pick her up and to take her to Target. And so they could show through cell phone records that she called him at like 8:30. He got to her house at 8:40. They got to Target at like 8:55. You could see them walk into Target. They had a receipt together at Target. You could see them at Target returning the comforter. You could also see them at the GameStop buying a video game. They then go to like TGI Fridays and have like dinner. He's having a conversation with a friend while at TGI Fridays. All of this is like documented via cell phone and via receipt. He gives all of this to his lawyer to document the fact that while this homicide is occurring, he is 10 miles away having dinner and returning this comforter, and the lawyer does not use it to document his alibi. Yes. And why doesn't he use it? Well, because he says that he feels like it's too complicated for the jury to understand. Okay, so bad lawyering, everyone. Hontuck Lee is another faulty forensic science case. It's another arson case. Arson is a big one. Arson, again, has evolved in the last couple of decades, and so what we, you know, once believed to be solid forensic science and arson investigation has just, a sea change has happened. And so you will hear about arson cases, especially in the Innocence Movement, and you will hear about arson cases, especially here in Allegheny County. We've got a couple. And we're going to be having, you're going to hear a couple. Daniel Carnival probably will be granted a new trial in the next couple of weeks here in Allegheny County, and hopefully Gregory Brown will be granted relief here soon in Allegheny County in federal court. So keep your ears and eyes open for those couple of arson cases. But Mr. Lee is a faulty forensic science case, and then is another arson case. John Miller. Mr. Miller is an incentivized testimony case and prosecutorial misconduct. Mr. Miller is a snitch case. It is a co-defendant case. Not really a co-defendant case. It's a a man who was in the same bar who says that he saw John Miller at the bar at the time of the homicide. It just places John Miller at the bar, and then prosecutors withhold evidence that the bartender actually says that he saw the actual perpetrator at the bar and do the shooting at the time of the homicide. Mr. Miller served 22 years in prison for that homicide. Mr. Patterson, bad lawyering and official misconduct, he served 17 years in prison for a homicide that he did not commit. I'm going to try to go through these a little more quickly. Larry Trent Roberts, eyewitness identification, incentivized testimony, bad lawyering, official misconduct. He served 13 years in prison for another homicide that he did not commit. Dante Rollins, eyewitness identification and bad lawyering. Terry Smallwood, she's another arson case here in the Commonwealth. 42 years in prison for an arson that she did not commit. Sean Thomas served 24 years in prison for a homicide that he did not commit. Mr. Thomas has the best alibi that I've ever seen. He was quite literally in juvenile court in front of a judge while the homicide was being committed, and the prosecution withheld the evidence that he was before the magistrate in order to prosecute Mr. Thomas. And actually, when it came out, it actually came out during, like, right before the closing arguments that Mr. Thomas may have been before the magistrate in juvenile court while this homicide was being committed. And so the prosecution argued that the signature on the subpoena before the magistrate was not Sean Thomas's signature, with no support whatsoever, and he was still prosecuted. Mr. Veazey. Mr. Veazey's primary causes are bad lawyering, official misconduct, and eyewitness misidentification. Mr. Veazey was working at a busy Houlihan's on a busy Friday night. He clocked in. He had his supervisor and several other coworkers testify at his trial that he was there, that he was working. But the prosecution argued that he could have snuck out, traveled 30 miles away, committed a homicide, and gotten back without anybody noticing. The main evidence against him was eyewitness misidentification, and really the thing that sealed his fate was official misconduct. The actual perpetrator was withheld from the defense counsel. He served 27 years. Mr. Veazey only got out in October of 2019. And Crystal Weimer. Crystal is a sweetheart. She has every primary cause in the book. She served 11 years for a homicide that she did not commit. Crystal's exoneration was actually the very first day that I started this position. Crystal was prosecuted for a homicide. The evidence against Crystal was so much crap. faulty forensic science. So she had bite mark evidence. Not bite mark evidence, really. It was a picture of Crystal's teeth against an elliptical bruise that they really couldn't say was a bruise because it was just a picture of a mark from 2 years ago from the autopsy on the body that they thought maybe was a bruise, But it really just was a mark. They couldn't really say it was a bruise. It could have just been like pooling of the blood. Okay? But they thought maybe it was a bite mark. Let me back up. Crystal's alleged victim's name was Curtis. Crystal was at a party. Curtis was also at a party on the night of his death. Curtis was found at 4 a.m., Crystal deceased. When they went to interview all of the party participants, Crystal was found hungover. She had blood on her sweatshirt. She had dirt on her sweatshirt. She was just a hot mess of a woman that morning, okay? So you can imagine why police would be like, oh, we would like to speak with you, right? And so she tells this story that she gets into a fight with her boyfriend that night. The boyfriend puts his finger in her face and she bites it. From that moment on, she is known as a biter. They test her sweatshirt, they take her sweatshirt, they test her sweatshirt, and the story works out. It is her boyfriend's blood on her sweatshirt. But she has already raised police officers' suspicions that she is a biter. So they now are pulling her over every time they see Crystal. They're pulling Crystal over because they have the idea that, like, Crystal is no good. And they have this picture of this elliptical-shaped bruise on the victim that they think is a bite mark. And Crystal is a biter. So they send this picture to a forensic odontologist in Fayette County. I neglected to tell you, this is a Fayette County case. So they send this picture to a forensic odontologist in Fayette County, and the forensic odontologist says, not only can I not say that Crystal's teeth impression match this mark, I can't even tell you that this is like a bruise or a bite mark in any way, shape, or form. And so, unfazed, they send out a picture of Crystal's teeth and this mark to a variety of forensic odontologists throughout the country. One comes back from Connecticut and says, I can match this mark to Crystal's teeth. And that is Dr. Karazoulis. And he says, it is an exact match, could be no one else. Great. So they arrest Crystal. They then take soil samples from outside of the victim's home, and they test the soil samples against the soil that is found on that sweatshirt that Crystal was wearing. And the forensic scientist is able to say that the soil samples are similar in grit and color. Brown. So, they have that. They then have a person, while Crystal is awaiting trial, they have a person who comes forward and says that he overheard Crystal admit to the homicide. And then his statement throughout the course, like over the course of the next several months before trial, his statement changes 27 times in order to fill in blanks to get to trial. So he says, okay, well, this is how the homicide occurred. They go and they look for evidence. So he says, Crystal says she threw the gun near this pond. They go and they like look for the gun. No gun. Crystal says they threw some piece of evidence in the woods here. They go and they look. That's not here. He changes his story again. Eventually, he changes his story so that he implicates himself in the homicide. He's doing time for a robbery. He actually ends up implicating himself in a much more serious crime than what he was doing time for in the first place. It's all very confusing. Anyway, he gives false testimony. He ends up pleading to a few more years than he would have done for the original crime for which he was arrested. So that's the false confession. And then the prosecutor, in her closing statements, there's one other witness that says that Crystal made some admissions while she was incarcerated. The prosecutor says that neither one has any kind of motive for making, for coming forward, for making these statements. When the project gets involved, there's a whole new prosecutor. Gives us access to the files, and there's letters upon letters from both witnesses that say, like, I'll do whatever you want. I'll tell you whatever you want on the Crystal Weimer case if you just give me, like, this, 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 and this. And so all of that should have been disclosed to defense counsel. That prosecutor who prosecuted Crystal Weimer's case is now a judge in Fayette County. Official misconduct. Crystal had three little girls when she was incarcerated. Two of those little girls went into foster care. Those little girls, her parental rights were terminated. She was not allowed to have telephone contact with those little girls. One of the little girls went with the paternal grandparents, so she was able to go with, like, family. She was able to have telephone contact sporadically, but, like, the way in which her family was torn apart is unfathomable. But what you see here is what Marsha was telling you is, like, is prosecutorial misconduct, racial bias, you know, all of these things. When I went through all of these cases, it's 17 men and women. Two of those men and women were white. 11% of our population in Pennsylvania are African American. This does not represent our population. Our criminal justice system disparately impacts our black and brown population. And there is no other explanation but for racial bias. I mean, right?
Yep.
And it's just, it disparately impacts the poor. It disparately impacts minorities. Please. Oh, so let me sum up. Out of all of those people, that's 401 years lost. So if I can put that in context for you for just a second, it's longer than, you know, people coming from the Mayflower. We can't even fathom that many years. You can't even wrap your head around as many years as those people I just told you about have lost. It's tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy. It's not just the tragedy of Lance and Eugene and Crystal and Kenneth Granger, but it's their daughters and their sons and their wives and every single person that is visiting them in prison and is surviving the incarceration with them.
A couple of facts and figures, and then another story, and then we'll open it up to questions, if that's okay with you guys. When I told you about the National Conference on Wrongful Convictions and the Death Penalty, which occurred in 1998, there were 78 exonerations from death row in America since 1974. There have now been 161. There have been 1,500 executions in America since 1974. 161 exonerations, 1,500 executions, it's 11%. Let me ask you what you think would happen in our society if out of every 100 flights of airplanes, 11 of them crashed. Would we stand for that? I don't think so. And yet, 11% of the people who were convicted of capital crimes in the United States, when you compare number of exonerations to number of executions, and, you know, until the execution happens, litigation is continuing, so we don't know the final story of the people who remain alive but on death row. But if you put those numbers together, 161 exonerations, 1,500 executions, 10.77% actually, but just under 11% wrongful convictions in capital cases. And what I think Liz will confirm is that as a criminal justice system, we try hardest to get the capital cases right. Right? We try hardest to get the capital cases right. And we still have 11% exoneration rate, just under 11% exoneration rate. As to misidentification that Liz talked about and how rampant misidentification is, let me encourage you to read a book called Picking Cotton. It's a story of a young woman who was a college student in Elon, North Carolina, who was raped in her apartment. She tried very hard when the assailant came into her apartment. She tried to do all these different things to make sure that she could see her assailant's face. For example, she said, "Oh, I'm really thirsty. I need something to drink. Can I get you something to drink?" Thinking the refrigerator light will come on when I open the refrigerator. She said to her assailant, "I really have to go to the bathroom. Will you please let me go to the bathroom?" So that she could turn on the bathroom light to catch a glimpse of her assailant's face, right? She does all these things. She believes ultimately that she's going to be killed, that she escapes from her apartment. She runs away and isn't killed, thank God. She's able to give a really detailed description of her assailant, and Ronald Cotton matches this description that she gives. Ronald Cotton vehemently denies that he commits this rape, and after many, many years, DNA evidence becomes available. It was not available at the time of Ronald's trial. After many years, DNA evidence becomes available, and Ronald's lawyer says to Ronald, "There's DNA evidence. You want us to run it? Because we've got some really good legal issues, but if we run the DNA and it doesn't exonerate you, those legal issues get flushed right down the toilet, because in addition to proving legal error, you also have to prove to courts that there's prejudice from the legal error that took place, right? And if the DNA matches, there's no prejudice to any of those legal errors, right?" So the lawyer says to Ron, "Really think about this seriously, because if we run the DNA and it's a match, all these really good other legal issues that we have, they get lost." Ron says, "Run the DNA, it wasn't me."
And he was convicted twice.
He was convicted twice. They run the DNA, he's exonerated. The victim, Jennifer Thompson, is called by the attorney and he tells her, "Jennifer, I got some news. Sit down. The man who we convicted not once but twice, the man who you identified as and exonerated, cannot be the man who raised you." And she, you know, understands, and she accepts it intellectually, but she has nightmares. And in her nightmares, she still sees Ronald Cotton. So she calls the district attorney and says, "I need to meet Ronald, because I still see him in my nightmares, even though I understand intellectually he could not have been the rapist." the DA says, well, let me call Ron's lawyer and see if they're willing to do that. The DA calls Ron's lawyer, a former law professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a good friend of mine named Rich Rosen, and says, hey, Rich, Jennifer Thompson wants to meet Ron. Would you ask Ron if he's willing to meet her? Rich asks Jennifer. Jennifer says, yeah, I'll meet him. So they agree to meet, and they come into the room, and she runs over to apologize. And Ronald stops her and says, you have nothing to apologize for. You got raped. You did the best you could to identify who your assailant was. And they embraced. And they have been close friends ever since. They travel around the country telling their story together about how mistaken this eyewitness identification can be, particularly if it's cross-racial. The man who ended up being convicted looked an awful lot like Ron Cotton. Ron's a little thinner. The assailant was a little heavier. But basically, their facial structures seemed similar. She didn't miss it by much. She just missed it by enough. And those of you who remember Don Adams and Get Smart, she missed it by that much. So read Pick and Cotton if you're interested in that issue. There's a movie that I'm going to recommend that you see that's coming out later in the month of December called Just Mercy. Yeah. It's about this. It's about the story of Walter McMillian, who was wrongfully convicted of a capital offense in Alabama, and who was exonerated from death row by a magnificently good lawyer named Brian Stevenson. And that book is a remarkably powerful book, Just Mercy. I encourage you to read that book. And the movie of that book is coming out later this month. Okay? We've spent an awful lot of time talking about wrongful convictions tonight. I want you to know that most of my clients are not innocent. Most of my clients are guilty of really, really horrific homicides. Really, really horrific homicides. But we still have no business killing them. And I'm going to tell you why. The United States Supreme Court has said that in deciding who should live and who should die, we have to use rational standards. Try and make that determination. And the court created a system where every homicide can't be charged capitally. In order to be a capital crime, there must be what are called aggravating circumstances, things that make the crime worse or the defendant more worthy of a death sentence. And we consider also mitigating circumstances, things about the offense or the offender that make that person less deserving of death. Would be? And the court says, well, we can, if we do those things, if we consider aggravating circumstances and mitigating circumstances, we can have a rational system. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And it doesn't work for lots of reasons. But it just doesn't work. And I'm going to tell you a story about one such case of a client of mine who was guilty. I've had innocent clients, and in fact, sad to say, I had a client who was exonerated after 34 years on death row, and I was one of his three trial lawyers, and he kept saying to me, Mr. Dion, I didn't do this. And I said, I believe you, Henry, but you confessed in a custodial interrogation, and when a reporter stuck a microphone and a TV camera in front of your face and asked you, did you do it? You said no, but then he said, what did you do? And you said, I just held her arm. And it was the rape and murder of a little girl. And so my client Henry McCollum was convicted of the rape and murder of this little girl and sentenced to death in spite of the fact that he had an IQ of 67 and was intellectually disabled. And we argued to the court, could not have made a knowing and intelligent waiver of his Miranda rights, and the court did not suppress his confession, though I believe to this day that it should have. I convinced Henry, I twisted Henry's arm. I spent hours doing this, twisting Henry's arm, to allow us to put on a diminished capacity defense, which means he had to admit his involvement in the homicide, because I fervently believed that a jury was going to convict him, and my preference was that the jury convict him of something less than first-degree murder, so that he could not be sentenced to death. Or that even if he was convicted of first-degree murder, the jury would have heard of his intellectual disability, of his difficult upbringing, his poverty, the racism in which he grew up, and decide to sentence him to life rather than death if it convicted him of first-degree murder. So I twisted his arm to allow us to put on that defense. And 34 years later, we discovered that the state had withheld fingerprint evidence, beer cans that had someone else's fingerprint on them, and there was DNA evidence available in 2014 that was not available in 1991 when we tried the case. And saliva on a cigarette butt matched the fingerprints on the beer cans that were suppressed. And there was another man who had been on North Carolina's death row who lives 300 yards from where this little girl's body was found, raped, and murdered. And the fingerprint evidence and the DNA evidence matched him, and he was already incarcerated. He had been on death row. His death sentence was overturned, but he was serving a life sentence without parole. And Henry McCollum and his younger brother, Leon Brown, both of whom were convicted of the rape and murder of this little girl, were finally exonerated. But that's not the story I want to tell you. The story I want to tell you is about a guy who absolutely committed the crime for which he was convicted, and his name was David Lawson. David was a young man who had moved to North Carolina from Michigan. He was raised in Central Michigan, Mount Pleasant, where Central Michigan University is. He had lived some in the UP. When he was 2 years old, his parents separated. His mom didn't think that she could both continue to work full-time as a nurse and raise him, so she left him with her parents, his maternal grandparents, so that she could continue to work and provide for him. His grandparents told me that for 4 months, from the day that his mom dropped him off, for 4 months, from the time he got up in the morning to the time he went to bed at night, all he did was sit at the window looking out for his mom. When he was a little older, 2-3 years later, she remarried. And so she was able to take him back. So there was, by the time he was 5 years old, separation, anxiety from having been taken from his mother, and then finally adapting to living with his grandparents, taken away from those grandparents and back to his mother. His stepfather was an alcoholic who was physically abusive to his mother. When David was 9 years old, his stepfather came home drunk, started beating on his mom, and David, who was built like me, short, stocky, charged his stepdad and knocked him down to get him off of his mother, and the stepdad put him out of the house. He said, "You can't live here anymore." So David lived on the street. He was taken in by some older boys who were burglars, and he was used as a lookout, 9-year-old boy used as a lookout. I told you that, one more before I get to this next part. I talked to his aunts in Michigan who said that when his mom would bring him over to their house, when they would leave, they would find clumps of hair around the house. David used to twirl his hair and rip it out in chunks
And the expert that I hired in David's case taught me that that is a symptom of serious anxiety disorder, and that David suffered with the worst anxiety disorder he, my expert, had ever seen, and a psychologist. In addition, he was bipolar, never diagnosed with bipolar disorder. But now let me get back to his life story. So he's living on the streets, used as a lookout by these older boys. At age 16, he tries to enlist in the military and is rejected because he has flat feet. And they say, no, sorry, we don't want you. So, having been rejected by the military, he then comes to North Carolina in search of his birth father. Remember, his parents separated when he was 2 years old. He comes to North Carolina in search of his birth father. I meet the woman at the Salvation Army who helped him find his birth father in Concord, North Carolina, just about 35, 40 minutes north of Charlotte, up I-85. And she told me the story of their meeting and his birth father saying to him, if I'd have wanted a son, don't you think I'd have found you by now? So rejected by his mother, rejected by his grandparents, rejected by his stepfather, and his mom let his stepfather throw him out, rejected by the military and rejected by his birth father all before he was 18 years old. He worked as a pulp wooder in North Carolina, and to supplement his income, learned some things from his mentors back up in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and became a burglar. And what he found was that when he had money, he could go into restaurants or bars and treat people well, buy them food, buy them drinks, and he could buy friends. And so, that encouraged him to keep being a burglar because he actually began to develop relationships as a result of being able to buy friendships. So he goes to a house that he hears has valuables in it in Cabarrus County, North Carolina, and he breaks into the house, doesn't find the valuables he thinks he's going to find. He's very careful, by the way, when he breaks in. Doesn't find the valuables he thinks he's going to find, and he goes to leave and is less careful upon leaving than he was upon entering, and sets off the alarm. The homeowner is just down the street at his dad's house, and they hear the alarm go off. So dad and son jump into dad's truck, and they drive up to the house. And the son says, "Dad, wait here, I'm going to go see what's going on." The son goes down to the house, surprises my client David Lawson, and David shoots him in the head and kills him. He then climbs up a hill, he sees dad sitting in the truck, and he shoots dad. Dad survives what would have been a fatal assault. Thank God. And is able to actually identify David Lawson. David gets arrested and charged with first-degree murder and says, I didn't do it. Tells his lawyer, I want you to put on defense, I didn't do it. The lawyer does what he can. David's convicted. But he had also told the lawyer, I don't want a life sentence. If I'm convicted of first-degree murder, don't do any investigation for mitigating evidence. Don't try and get me a life sentence. I don't want it. And the lawyer says, okay. So all that stuff that I told you about David's background, trial counsel never knew. The jury that sentenced David to death never knew. You think that might have made a difference? If jurors had heard about David's life and background, the stuff that I just told you, I certainly do think it would have made a difference. But trial counsel never investigated it, never presented it, couldn't be presented because he had no idea. David was sentenced to death. I get involved in the case, I meet David, and this, what I'm going to tell you now, is very common. I went to see David a few times, and early on, in one of our early meetings, we get into a fight, and he cusses at me and tells me to leave. And it happens a lot in my cases that my clients test me early on. They're used to being abandoned. Most of my clients have been abandoned in the course of their lives, the same way that David was. And so when I went back to see David 2 weeks later, he says, "What are you doing here? Did I tell you to go back to yourself?" And I said, "Yeah. Here's what I want you to know, David. Human beings have arguments all the time. It doesn't mean that it's the end of their relationships. We can disagree about lots of stuff. I promise you over the course of the next few years, we will disagree about lots of stuff. You're going to tell me to F myself. I'm going to tell you to F yourself. But you know what? I'm going to still be your lawyer, and you're going to still be my client, and we're going to get along." Because that's what people do. That's what happens in normal relationships, is people have disagreements, but it doesn't mean the relationship is over. But David was so used to abandonment that that's what he came to expect. Okay? On death row, you're on death row in North Carolina, and in many states, you're required to be seen by a clinical psychologist. He's seen by the clinical psychologist at the Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. The clinical psychologist says, "David, I think you have really severe bipolar disorder. I'd like you to get seen by a psychiatrist." Initially, David says, thanks, but no. But finally, the clinical psychologist convinces him, be seen by the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist sees him and diagnoses him with really severe bipolar disorder and puts him on medication. David gets put on medication and boom, like that, no more FUs to me or anybody else. He says to me one day, I feel completely different since I've been on this medication. And here's the thing, I feel terrible about the fact that I took someone's life. I'm finally realizing the enormity of the fact that I took a young father from kids, a young husband from a wife, a son from parents. I got to do something about this. Can I write the family and say I'm sorry? I said, yeah, you can write the family and say you're sorry. Don't do it more than once. I don't want you to be bugging them. I don't think they're going to accept your apology, but can you do it? Yeah, you can do it. So he did. A little while later, he says to me, "You know any reporters that might want to talk to me?" I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, you know, there might be people out there who are undiagnosed with bipolar disorder, like I was. And maybe if they heard my story, maybe they'd go see treatment. And if I could do something to balance the karmic scales, like if I could do something to sort of help people because I did such a horrible thing, I'd feel a little better about myself." I said, "Yeah, David, there are reporters who would want to talk to you." He says, "Because they can ask me whatever they want. I'll tell them pretty much whatever they want. But I'll find a way to make sure that they hear about this part of it too." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm presenting the evidence in court about what didn't get presented at trial and all of the stuff about your background and the fact that you were undiagnosed and that you should have been diagnosed, you should have been evaluated by a mental health professional by your, your trial lawyer should have had a mental health professional involved in your case. I'm raising all that stuff in court." He said, No, I don't want to tell the story to try and get sympathy. That's not the point. I want to tell the story to help somebody else." I said, "Okay." So we start getting news people to come in, and this story starts getting out. Meanwhile, as we go through state post-conviction and federal habeas corpus, and then the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and in each of these courts, we're losing our claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, despite what I think is pretty good evidence of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And so David starts to get more and more frenetic about getting this story out as we get further along in the legal process. And finally he says, "I want you to call Phil Donahue." Now, you guys might not know who Phil Donahue was. But Phil Donahue was Oprah before it was Oprah. All right? And he says, call Phil Donahue. I want to tell this story to Phil Donahue. I say, okay. So I call Multimedia Incorporated, the owner of the Phil Donahue show, and I pitch it. And they say, yeah, that sounds interesting to us. Meanwhile, David says, because we're getting closer to execution, because he's losing, David says, I want my execution to be televised. I said, what? He says, I'm convinced that if North Carolinians see an execution, actually see an execution, they will turn against the death penalty in huge numbers. And I said, David, you're out of your mind. We live in a society that absolutely loves violence. Are you kidding me? And the story that's going to be told, if this ever were to be televised, is of what a horrible, horrible, horrible criminal you are and how deserving you are of what's about to happen. That's the story that's going to get told. He says, I don't care. I said, well, I do. Because, you know, I don't think it's going to work out the way you want it. He says, that's okay. Don't worry about it, Marshall. I'll tell Phil. And he tells Phil Donahue. And Multimedia Incorporated sues the state of North Carolina for the right to televise David Lawson's execution. They lose, thank God. But on the morning before David Lawson was executed by the state of North Carolina, on June 6th, 1994, Phil Donahue aired a one-hour episode telling David Lawson's story, talking to me, talking to his political psychologist, talking to a cousin of his, talking to the victim's family, telling the entire story, the good parts and the bad. And David and I watched that episode of the Phil Donahue show together on the morning before he was executed. Now, in North Carolina at the time, the method of that David was convicted and sentenced to death, the method of execution in North Carolina was the gas chamber. By the time the execution was about to take place, North Carolina had changed the method of execution to lethal injection. But David had to sign a waiver saying that he would accept the lethal injection instead of the gas chamber. So I bring him the form, which I assume he's going to sign, and he says, I'm not signing this. And I said, what? He says, I'm not signing this. I said, why not? He said, Marshall, don't you see the irony? When I was undiagnosed and untreated for my bipolar disorder, I told my lawyer I wanted the death sentence. And I participated in the process by which the death sentence was imposed. And now I've been diagnosed and treated, and they want me to participate in the process again? Let the state of North Carolina do what the state of North Carolina is going to do. But I'm not signing anything. I said, David, it's your decision, but I'm going to bring you affidavits of people that have seen gas chambers, have seen people dying in a gas chamber, and I want you to read them because they are horrible and it is an extraordinarily painful way to die. And, you know, you and I have known each other for 8 years, and I don't want you to go through that. I'd really rather you not. So I brought him the affidavits, and I went back the next day, and he read them. And he said, boy, that was some gruesome reading. I said, good, you're going to sign the form. He said, no. So on June 6th of 1994, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was in a little room with David's psychologist and one of my co-counsel, some of the victim's family members, and we watched as a little tablet of cyanide got dropped into a bucket of ammonia, and it began to produce a gas. And we could see a cloud of gas rise up from the bucket that was underneath his chair. And David took a deep breath, turned real red in the face, gathered himself, and screamed out, "I am human!" And each breath, he did that. He began to drool, his face turned white, his body convulsed. He broke one of the straps that strapped his leg to the chair because of the convulsions. And he shouted out, "I am human!" until he couldn't say the whole sentence anymore. And then he said, "Human!" And a few minutes later, he could only say, "Hume!" And a few minutes later, he could only grunt to let us know that he was still alive. And that began at 2:01 in the morning, and he was pronounced dead at 2:18 in the morning. And under North Carolina law, there had to be a 5-minute flatline on an EKG. So it took 12 minutes of agony in the state of North Carolina to execute David Lawson. And I told that story to Mr. Donahue a couple of days later. And he said, "I'm going to get you an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. I want you to describe what you saw so that people can read it." And I wrote that op-ed piece, and it was scheduled to run in the Washington Post, except on the day before it was supposed to run, there was this slow white Bronco chase on a freeway in Los Angeles. It sort of knocked everything else off of the pages of the newspaper. So, having watched my client, who I come to know and really admire, die in the gas chamber, I was unable really to write any appellate briefs the rest of that summer or into the fall. And I had to keep getting extensions from the courts for my work because I was just frozen. And only in retrospect did I realize, that that's called a major depressive episode. I didn't know that that's what was going on in my life. Except, as I say, when I looked back and thought about it, I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, I get it. That's what a major depressive episode is." That fall, words are a little odd. I was commemorating a lot of these events and celebrating the Jewish high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, where we're really supposed to do an annual reflection of our lives and figure out how we can improve our lives and what we've done wrong and how we can do better. And I thought, wow, I don't think I've ever met anybody who had done more of that than David Lawson did after he was diagnosed and treated for bipolar disorder. So the next summer, I really needed some sort of a little renewal, some spiritual renewal. And I decided to go to a 5-day religious retreat sponsored by the Reform Movement up at Brandeis University. 5 days of prayer and study, studying the Torah and, religious texts. And so I go up to Brandeis, and on the first day of this retreat, I sit down and I'm eating breakfast with some people, and they say, they introduce themselves and where they're from and ask me, what my name is and where I'm from and what do I do, and they tell them, "I'm a lawyer." "Oh, what kind of law do you practice?" "Well, criminal law." "Any particular specialty?" "Well, as a matter of fact, yeah, I do capital cases." "Oh, how interesting. That must be really interesting. Did you meet Andrew?" "No, who's Andrew?" "Andrew's this guy we just met a few minutes ago who's from New Jersey. He just served on a capital jury." I said, "No, really, how about that?" And I go from breakfast to my morning religious services, and I really take my religious services pretty seriously, and that morning I could not concentrate on my prayers. Why? Because sitting in that room with me was this Andrew guy who had served on a capital jury and sentenced someone to death, and I was pretty disgusted by it. And I thought to myself, boy, I've come up here for this spiritual renewal, and here I am in a room with other Jewish people praying, and there's a guy in here who voted to kill somebody? Ugh, makes me sick. And after services were over, I went up to tell a rabbi about, how I was feeling, because there was no shortage of rabbis at this religious retreat. And he says to me, do you know the Yiddish word beshert? And I said, nope, don't know Yiddish. He says, well, beshert is sort of it's a Yiddish word that is used usually in the romantic context. It's kismet. It's serendipity. Two people meet, they fall in love, it's beshert. I said, well, how does that apply to me? He says, you and Andrew are here together for a reason. I want you to go meet Andrew, and I want you to talk to him. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. Good call. Good call. I can hardly wait.
Thanks, Rabbi.
And I get to my first class, and guess who's in class with me? Because we go around the room, and it's Andrew from New Jersey. So after the class is over, I go up and I say, hey, Andrew, and we start to talk. And over the course of 5 days, I tell him what I do and why I do it. And he tells me about his experience serving on this capital jury. And we really sort of engage with one another and wrestle with this thing. And on the last day of the retreat, I'm eating breakfast again, because as you can tell, I don't miss meals. He says to the people sitting across from me with whom I'm talking, he says, do you mind if I take Marshall away? Marshall, do you got a minute? And I said, I still got Rice Krispies here, Andrew. No idea. I said, sure, let's talk. And we go for a walk, and he starts telling me a story in the third person, which is a little odd, because the story is about him. And he says, there was this juror. This juror was serving on this homicide jury, and we hear all the evidence, and we hear the instructions that the judge rattles off at you for an hour, and we don't understand anything that the judge has just said. We have no idea what we're supposed to do, except we heard the part about electing a foreperson. So we go into the jury room, and we know we're supposed to elect a foreperson, so we elect a foreperson, and then we go, okay, what happens now? And everybody shrugs their shoulders. And the foreperson says, well, why don't we take a straw poll? And so they go around the table, right? And each juror says, guilty, 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 guilty. Though they get to the 12th, and the 12th juror says, not guilty. And because the 12th juror says not guilty, they actually got to start to talk about it. Like, what did the state prove? Did the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt? Did the defense create any doubt? Is there any wiggle room? Is it possible that one of the witnesses misidentified who he or she saw? Is it possible that there was some incentivized testimony? And after about 5 hours, they finally conclude that yes, indeed, the state has proven this person's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they are about to go back into the courtroom, and they knock on the door to go back into the courtroom from the jury room, and just before they go in, somebody says, wait, before we go back in there, 5 hours ago, you voted not guilty. I'm just curious, did you really think he was not guilty 5 hours ago? And the guy says, no, I thought he was guilty just like you guys did. But if we'd all said guilty when we took the straw poll, we wouldn't have done any of that talking. And I decided, in the case where this person is charged with the worst crime known to our law, maybe we ought to wrestle with it. Maybe we ought to think about it. Maybe we ought to talk about it and make damn sure that we're making the right decision. And that's pretty cool. Andrew looks at me and he says, at that moment, I was more embarrassed and ashamed of myself than I've ever been in my entire life. Because that should have been me, Marshall. And it wasn't me. He says, what you do for a living is pretty hard. I bet it gets you tired. But I sure hope you keep doing it. Because you do what that guy did in our jury room. You make us think about and talk about the death penalty. Because we as a society are responsible for it. It's our policy, you know, in a democratic society. We get to make those decisions. And if we don't think about it, and we don't talk about it, and it just happens because we don't think about it or talk about it, we're not doing our jobs. I sure hope you keep doing what you're doing. And he gives me this huge hug. At which point I felt more embarrassed and ashamed than I've ever felt in my life, because I thought back to that first day about how I had dehumanized this person who sat on a Capitol jury and voted to kill someone. And I realized that as long as I've been doing Capitol work, I didn't know how easy it was to dehumanize another human being. And darn, if I can do it, anybody can do it. And so what I'm here to ask you tonight is to think about, wrestle with, our state policy, our federal policy, of intentionally taking the lives of other human beings who do bad things and do good things, who have done hateful things and have done loving things, who hate people and who love people. Because that's what all of us do. My clients, Liz's clients, they're just not that different from us. They're really, really, really a lot like us. Her clients haven't done bad things. My clients have. But I ask you to think about it and wrestle with it, and if you conclude that intentionally taking the life of another human being is something you don't want to be a part of, then, for goodness sake, get involved. If you want to do that, you can start tomorrow night, because Pennsylvanians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty meets the first Wednesday of every month at the First Unitarian Church on Warwood Avenue at 7 o'clock. And we'll be there tomorrow night. If you can't be there tomorrow night, be there in January, be there in February, in March. But let's go beyond that. Meetings are great. I love them. I do a lot of them in my business. But there are other things to do. Write your legislators. Go to town hall meetings and during election time. We got an election coming up, and lots and lots and lots of candidates at all levels of government are going to be coming through, talking to you and wanting your vote. Ask them, do you really think that it's in our best interest as a society to teach, as a government, to teach that violence is an answer to solving our problems. Louis Brandeis wrote in a Fourth Amendment case that for good or ill, the government is the omnipresent teacher, the omnipotent teacher, excuse me. For good or ill, it teaches the entire people by its example. Do we want to set as a moral example for the rest of us the government intentionally taking human life? If we don't tell your legislators, this is not acceptable to me, write to the prosecutors and say, you have discretion to not charge capitally. Exercise that discretion to not prosecute people for the death penalty. It's inappropriate. When there are capital trials, if you have the time and ability, go to the courthouse and sit in on those trials, because I'm going to promise you that if you sit there and watch jury selection, what you will see is African American people getting struck from juries on a routine basis. They will never, never, never use that as the excuse, but prosecutors find reasons to exclude African Americans and people of color from jury service in this country and in this state.
Well, and even and as a foundation, African Americans don't get called for jury service because African Americans are over-policed and over-incarcerated, and discrimination against in our criminal justice system and have felonies at a higher rate, so aren't eligible for jury duty. So we don't have, they are underrepresented in jury duty, and so they are underrepresented in jury service. And so,
so even the people of color who are called for jury service, and Liz is absolutely right, people of color are underrepresented in jury pools, even the people of color who are called for jury service are routinely excluded from jury service in our system. So be witnesses. I'm not talking about testifying witnesses. I'm talking about being witnesses to the flaws in our criminal justice system and say, no, we're not putting up with this. This is a democratic society. This is not the way we want to run the railroad. And Liz and I are both here to answer any questions that you have, and I'm sorry if I went on too long. I apologize.
So if I can just follow up just with one thing, is that when I was a public defender, so the way in which we do the death penalty just state-wise is here in Allegheny County, there is a group of prosecutors that get together and they decide whether a homicide case has the aggravating circumstances that warrant the imposition of the death penalty. They sit in their room and they decide whether those aggravating circumstances are present. Those prosecutors, there's three or four of them in the county here in Allegheny County. The lead prosecutor, when I was a public defender, who was a very powerful prosecutor in that office, drank a lot. I'm telling you this because not to disparage this prosecutor, but because I want you to see that our criminal justice system is just as flawed as we are, as humans. Why? Because we run it, right? And so this prosecutor had a significant other who the prosecutor accused of domestic violence and had a restraining order against. No one's sure whether that was an accurate complaint, okay? But the restraining order was a legal court order. A few days after the restraining order was issued, a 911 call came in from the prosecutor, from the landline of that significant other's home. And the police showed up and arrested that significant other, and that prosecutor was in trouble for being at the significant other's home with the restraining order. That prosecutor claimed that they had been kidnapped. That later turned out to be a false claim. Now, this is a person who obviously is abusing the power of their office, right, by making false claims and using the police to punish their significant other for domestic issues. This is also a person who is making life or death decisions in Allegheny County and who is imposing the death penalty. Is that who we trust to make life or death decisions here in Allegheny County? And that's that. Unfortunately, that's like our community doesn't know that. Our community doesn't know the people who are making these decisions and the nitty-gritty of like what's happening within our prosecution's offices, you know, and what's happening behind closed doors for the unchecked power. But it isn't pretty. And I'm not saying that all of the prosecutors in our office are like that. Absolutely not. There are some very good prosecutors in our offices that are protecting our communities. But unfortunately, we're human, and we all are fallible, and
And the death penalty in our laws and our prosecutor's offices and our public defender's offices are fallible just like we are. And so do we really want to institute the ultimate punishment when we're not sure we can get it right?
Brian Stevenson says in his book, Just Mercy, none of us wants to be judged by the next person we ever heard of that.
Yeah.